Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nelson Mandela once said, "I dream of an Africa which is at peace with itself." It can seem a mercilessly distant dream. The high hopes of Live 8 concerts and G8 summits and South Africa today inspire. The gritty reality of AIDS, corruption, famine, and war can breed despair. This hour on Point, the long view of Africa with journalist and historian Martin Meredith. But first, we begin with news of Africa's latest famine in Niger. Hillary Anderson, Africa correspondent for the BBC, was part of the team that broke the hidden story. She joins us now from her base in Johannesburg, South Africa. Hillary, thanks for being with us.
Hello.
So what's the latest news on the hunger in Niger?
Well, it's an extremely serious situation, and as the days and weeks progress, it gets worse and worse, because this is the very tail end of the agricultural year, and it is only a few weeks now until the next harvest, which for the lucky few in the very southernmost belt of Niger may mean that they have some food perhaps by the end of September. But what that means for right now is that they have absolutely nothing. And we're talking about 800,000 children facing starvation and a total of 2.5 million people in urgent need of food. And the aid agencies have now started to move in quite a serious way. But the task of getting food to that many people within the short window of opportunity that there is extremely difficult and daunting.
And we know the edges of this have reached beyond Niger to Mali, Mauritania, Burkina Faso. Remind us, if you would, Hillary, what led to this famine? Why?
Well, there was a drought across that entire part of North and West Africa last year in 2004, and that was followed by a plague of locusts. And the combination of these two devastating forces of nature was that the harvest in not just Niger, but as you say, Mali, Mauritania, and also Burkina Faso was largely or completely ruined, which meant that what people were supposed to survive on all year, they basically ate up in the first few months after last year's harvest. And many people in Niger in particular have been without food for around 9 months now.
There's been stern criticism both of the leadership in Niger and of the UN and for the pace of its response to this. Was the ball dropped in both quarters? What's gone on?
Well, the UN was asking several months ago for other international countries to come up and with some money to help the situation in Niger, because everybody knew this was coming. It was no great surprise. We're talking about a drought a year ago and a plague of locusts many months ago.
Yep.
In the second poorest country on earth. Donor countries simply did not respond to the UN's appeals. They fell on deaf ears, and the government of Niger was very reluctant to come out and call this a famine or call this as bad a situation as it is, because it's a very sensitive issue and word in that particular part of Africa. Famine situations have been known to bring governments down. So the government there has been extremely reluctant to talk about it openly.
You're talking about 800,000 people starving. Could the international community have prevented that whole problem? Is it the capacity there to do it if it had been on top of it earlier?
Absolutely. During the G8 summit, several billion dollars of extra aid was pledged to Africa. It's only a matter of a few million that was needed on time to stop people from dying of starvation in Niger. The money simply wasn't allocated to the right places on time, and that is in spite of the fact that there is an international warning system which rang the alarm bells. So you really have to ask the question, does the international system for responding to growing emergencies work? And I think the answer where this crisis is concerned is a resounding no.
And you also have to ask about the kind of irony here, the famine in Niger. Essentially, the same time the G8 leaders were meeting and people were dancing in stadiums around the world for Live 8.
Yes, very ironic. And people around Europe wearing white armbands as a symbol of their concern about poverty in Africa to go along with the G8 summit, whereas in Niger, the little children that we were seeing out there were having these armbands put on their tiny arms or their feet to determine what level of starvation they had reached. So people with red armbands were severely malnourished, orange armbands moderately malnourished, but all of these children emaciated beyond belief, a lot of them suffering from a condition called marasmus, which is the type of starvation which basically leads the body to waste away and your metabolism slows down, your functions start to shut off one by one. You know, it's a terrible, terribly painful and excruciating way to die, and it could have been stopped, and it wasn't.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan headed to Niger next week. We want to be sure we understand going out here, Hillary. Is full supply of food now headed in there? Will this famine be cut short? Are we going to be on top of it soon?
Well, not really. It's not as simple as that. Yes, the world is now responding and aid is flowing in, but it's a huge crisis. We're talking about millions of people in four different countries. Getting food to that many people as quickly as they need it, and as I was saying, they need it now, they needed it weeks ago, months ago, is just an overwhelming task. It's a tough logistical task. You have to get trucks down hundreds of miles of desert roads. These are vast desert countries where people are, you know, scattered all over the desert. So the food is going, but it's not getting there fast enough, and there isn't enough money that's been given to the international community. The World Food Program, for example, still only has raised less than half of the $57 million that it needs in Niger alone. And it's a similar situation in the other countries.
Hillary Anderson, thank you for your reporting, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Hillary Anderson, Africa correspondent for the BBC. She joined us from Johannesburg. If Niger's famine turns the face of Africa once again to despair, it's important to remember it wasn't always so. In its early days of post-colonial independence a half century ago, the continent was bursting with exuberance and anticipation of a new chapter about to turn. Journalist and historian Martin Meredith was there. He saw the hope, and he saw it drain away under the weight of colonial history, economic collapse, drought, disease, and African leaders who took the people and the land into its dizzying downward spin. This hour on Point, Martin Meredith and the fate of Africa now. You can join the conversation. After all the exhilaration of Live 8 and the declarations of the G8, what are the real prospects for Africa today? Do you see a reason for real hope in Africa, in Darfur, in Niger, and beyond? Could this be a continent beyond hope? Is it dangerous even to think that? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from a BBC studio in Oxford, England, is Martin Meredith. He is an historian, researcher, and journalist. His new book, drawing on 40 years of reporting and research, is The Fate of Africa, From the Hopes of Freedom to the Heart of Despair. Martin Meredith, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So you open the book with a remarkable image, and it comes from that time of hope. 1964, you were 21 years old, and you set out from Cairo, traveling up the Nile into Central Africa to your, what I took maybe to be your first job as a reporter at the Times of Zambia. Give us a point of perspective here. What was the air of hope and anticipation at that time, Martin Meredith?
Well, it was believed that independence would lead to an era of prosperity, peace, development. There was huge enthusiasm amongst the kind of general populations for independence. Politicians came to power. They'd been popularly elected. And many of them had had little training for the job, but their commitment to the idea of development was undisputed. Unfortunately, the ambitions were too great. I mean, Africa has always been a continent which has been a difficult place in which to kind of to survive and certainly to develop. And I think that the ambitions, although laudable at the time, were too great. And that led to too many projects being started and collapsing because they weren't properly managed. And for the sense of optimism and hope that was so apparent at independence to gradually dissipate.
And your personal sense of
hope or despair now?
Now, after a 40 year, nearly 50 years in some cases, span of independence, except in a few isolated cases, the fate of the continent is more precarious, I think, than it ever has been before. And I think that the scale of the problem that most African states face is of such magnitude that it is almost beyond the realm of feasible solutions. That is that there are all kinds of things which can be done and which will no doubt be done. But now what one is looking at is a sort of a 30 to 40 year period of decline and decay, which has meant that governments throughout the continent, again with some exceptions, but are now barely able to kind of to cope with providing the minimum of public services. And the commitments that foreign governments make, rather like the G8 summit and so on, they raise false expectations about what can be achieved just by agreeing to debt relief or giving more aid and so on. These things are all helpful, but they don't really begin to kind of tackle the scale of the problem. So I'm, on the whole, fairly pessimistic, although I would say that it's worthwhile taking a realistic approach to the scale of the problems rather than to depend on rather kind of false hopes aroused at international meetings.
We want to look at exactly that, at the light shown by G8, by Live 8, and at your very long, intimate personal experience of Africa. It's a long way from 1965, and you on that boat headed up the Nile, Martin Meredith. We want to take full advantage of what you've learned in the years between. We're talking this hour about the African challenge with Martin Meredith, author of the big new book on Africa, The Fate of Africa, From the Hopes of Freedom to the Heart of Despair. You can join the conversation. Do you see the reasons for hope? Or with Darfur and Niger and AIDS and poverty, is this still the continent of despair? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This hour we're talking about the African challenge with Martin Meredith, journalist, historian, biographer. His big new book is The Fate of Africa, From the Hopes of Freedom to the Heart of Despair. You can join the conversation. After all the hope and hoopla of the Live 8 concerts and the G8 declaration, what are the real prospects for Africa today? Where do you stand between hope and despair on this great continent? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Martin Meredith, there's so much we want to hear from you, but we want to get a little bit of a bead on you first. You were in Africa for a long time, a British guy, a reporter, 15 years as a correspondent, many years as a researcher. Where do you come from on this? You're not the crusty old longing for the colonial days guy asking for a Pimm's or a gin and tonic and saying it's all hell now, are you?
No, I'm someone who, in a sense, went to Africa with a sense of adventure and, in a way, never came back because there was so much drama, so much adventure, so much to report on. What I admire most is the extraordinary kind of courage and resilience of Africa's people. And that is almost the kind of strongest reason for hope. So I'm not one of those who knocks back gins and tonics and harks back to the colonial era. And indeed, I arrived in Africa at the end of the colonial era and the beginning of the independence era. And it seemed to me, even in retrospect, as to be an inevitable and indeed desirable a series of events. The colonial era, the late colonial era, brought to Africa a quite modest rate of development. But what was necessary was to release the energy and enthusiasm of the people, and that's what independence did. But on the whole, Africa's people have been badly let down by their own leaders, and that is probably one of the greatest causes of Africa's decline and decay today. And Africa's leaders kind of don't get any better somehow. We were talking earlier about the problems of Niger.
Yes.
Well, there you're looking at another disaster, for which there is, in a sense, failure can be attributed all round, but certainly to the president of Niger.
Because he didn't raise the flag earlier, he didn't want to talk about it, he didn't bring in the aid.
He didn't. I mean, the failure is, in a sense, in two parts. Principally, it's the failure of the government of Niger, who've known for 9-10 months that aid was going to be necessary. The president even had a meeting with George Bush in Washington,
right?
Which was a rare opportunity for him to blow the whistle, to ask for help. Mm-hmm. He never even mentioned that there was a disaster looming. He never even went to the famine areas until Hillary Anderson's film was shown on the BBC and when public concern abroad. And that is an example, if you like, of the way in which Africa's leaders let down their own people. For reasons of prestige, for reasons of the loss of face and so on, he is not prepared to raise the alarm when there are millions of people in danger of starvation. What? And there is equal blame in some ways nowadays attached to the aid industry. They are highly paid professional organizations that have huge resources at their disposal. They were lax in sounding the alarm. And in a sense, as Hillary Anderson was saying, it's totally avoidable disaster. None of this need have happened. Hundreds of thousands of people could have been saved, and yet it ends up in a disaster. The principal cause, well, I would attribute to the failure of the president of Niger.
Martin Meredith, you paint such an enormous, rich mural here, and you're a great storyteller. Niger is right in front of us, so is Darfur, but you've got 40 years to draw on. You're very critical of African leadership, and I want to dig into that, but I wish you'd pull out of that big mural a couple of stories or anecdotes that illustrate, from your own personal experience, your direct observation, the leadership failings that have made you so sour on African leadership. Tell us some stories.
We can take other examples of famines which were avoidable. One of my most enduring memories as a foreign correspondent was arriving in Ethiopia in 1973, shortly after the Arab-Israeli Yom Kippur War, where there were reports of large-scale famine in certain areas of northern Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And so I hired a car. I travelled up the main road for kind of 250 miles, and there I came across people dying by the side of the road. The evidence for a disaster was all there. You didn't really have to do very much more than spend a day driving up the road to find it. But back in the capital, Addis Ababa, the government was shrugging its shoulders. This was just another kind of routine event as far as the government was concerned. But what was even more horrifying, when I got back to Addis Ababa, I discovered that the warehouses in Addis Ababa were full of food supplies. There wasn't a shortage of food, but they were under the control of merchants who were benefiting from the price rises that were going on day by day. And so they saw a benefit in holding on to food rather than distributing it.
And the leadership didn't step in and break that and get the food out of those warehouses?
No. It didn't. At that particular time, it was under the leadership of Emperor Haile Selassie, and he took the view that these were sort of natural disasters that happened and had happened in the course of Ethiopia's history. Almost every kind of decade, there was a disastrous drought and their consequent famine, and so nothing was done. Well, that's one example, if you like, of the failure of leadership. But you can go back to Ethiopia the following decade, where there was an even more, if you like, famous famine, the one which eventually precipitated Live Aid,
right.
And all the kind of musical events then. But the famine there, again, was totally avoidable. Ethiopia was then under the control of a military dictator, Mengistu Haile Mariam,
right.
Who was faced with rebellions in the north, and was using starvation as a means of warfare, and preventing or indeed destroying food supplies. He was embarked on scorched earth policies, which literally was destroying the food supplies of the local population.
The principal cause
of that famine, of which there was a huge concern in the outside world, was military repression and the destruction of food supplies. It wasn't principally connected to drought.
I want to ask you, you write very vividly about the European powers' colonial carve-up of Africa, how arbitrary it was, how the great powers almost literally stood over maps chortling in Europe that they didn't even know the mountains and rivers they were swapping and drawing borders through here, but wasn't it great fun doing it? In the end, unlike some, you still end up, despite that wrenching history that Africa's come through and all the dislocation and exploitation that went with it, you still point the finger at African leadership. You know, the thing I never quite get is, maybe you can give us a sense of it, if there's a general rule to be described here. What's the chain that brings people to power in Africa? Why is it not bringing better people to power in Africa? What's the path to power?
Well, the path to power really is, it, put it a slightly different way, politics in Africa is a means of self-enrichment. That the objective of politicians is to gain power so that they can earn a fortune. And that has been going on for kind of 40 or 50 years. African leaders have not wanted to rule through parliaments or even through constitutions, but usually through by direct sort of one-party state regimes, which give them virtually total control of government revenues and of the local population.
Why don't we see more of the Nelson Mandela-style leadership? We know he's an extraordinary individual, and you don't get that many of those in a century. Still, why not more of that flavor of caring for the whole, even across racial lines, that kind of big-hearted, big, large-minded view of leadership? Why not at least smaller echoes of that more commonly?
Well, there are a number of African leaders who stand out for making valiant attempts to institute governments which have a much more creditable record. But the result usually has not necessarily been favorable. In Tanzania, for example, there was a leader called Julius Nyerere, who was
yes.
president for nearly 25 years, who was a committed socialist. He himself was not in the least interested in any kind of personal benefit from government, which was unusual. But his policies were more or less disastrous. He went in for what really amounted to forced collectivization, much against the kind of the will of the population, and that brought the population almost to the verge of starvation. It certainly was disastrous in terms of the country's development. So there you actually have a kind of a well-meaning leader with the right credentials in terms of good governance and so on, but instituting policies which were disastrous. There have been other leaders who've stood out for their courage in insisting on good governance. In Botswana, it's a country in southern Africa, the first independence leader, a man called Seretse Khama, he was a man who insisted on moderate measures, on compromise, on negotiation, on bringing people with him. And the result is that his legacy, when he eventually kind of died, is that Botswana is the most enduring multi-party democracy in Africa.
And we could wish for more of that kind of democracy. We're talking this hour with Martin Meredith. His new book is The Fate of Africa. We're going to be speaking later in this hour with Bioli Ireli. He is professor of African studies at Harvard University, born and raised in Nigeria. He's listening in right now. We want to be sure to have African voices in this conversation about Africa. Listeners, you're very welcome on that score as well. I want to begin to turn to our callers, if I may, Martin Meredith. We're at 1-800-423-8255, and Bill is calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill, you're on the air.
Good morning. Your guest is right on the money when it comes to African leadership. It is appalling. None of the black African leadership, for example, has stood up to Robert Mugabe and his actions in Zimbabwe, particularly someone like Thabo Mbeki. And Thabo Mbeki, who everybody had such high hopes in.
Right next door in South Africa, fairly accepting of Mugabe in the last several years.
Unbelievable. And he is without... this is a Harvard graduate, and this is a man who is an absolute disaster. I mean, his policies on AIDS, coming out with the argument that HIV does not cause AIDS, and listening and consulting herbalists, for example, and having a health minister who is about as incompetent as incompetent can be. It's just stunning. I remember when apartheid was in force, and I remember black African leadership criticizing the West for being hypocritical. Now the tables are turned, and they are every bit as hypocritical as they accused the white Western powers at that particular time.
Easy to say, easy to throw stones, and plenty of reason for that, but why do you think this happens, Bill? Why?
You know, that's the part that I cannot understand. I'm not as well-versed as your guest. I've been studying this for years. I think part of it, and this is just a guess on my part,
yes.
Part of it has to do with the tribal nature of Africa. I mean, they do not look at themselves nationally. They first and foremost look at themselves locally.
And a lot of national lines didn't get drawn along those lines. Bill, thanks for your call. Martin Meredith, take us once more to the White. And what about Thabo Mbeki? You, including this, you quote him in a speech in Japan, really objecting to what I hear kind of riding behind your comments, what he called a dogma of African exceptionalism, according to which the color black becomes a symbol of fear, evil, and death. I mean, I hear your magnanimity in this book, and I read it as well, and yet if Mbeki heard your description of Africa, might not he accuse you of painting it as a continent of fear, evil, death, the dark continent?
Well, I could be accused of that, but I would argue against him. I wouldn't accept that. In the case, there are a number of issues there. The first one is of Zimbabwe, which is a country which has been devastated by another African dictator, and the only reason for it is that he wants to stay in power and uses violence and other means to ensure that that happens. I think I agree in a sense with the caller that Thabo Mbeki's handling of the Zimbabwe issue is to be deplored, but he is not in a sense responsible for creating the mess that Zimbabwe is in. And if one is looking at sort of the continent as a whole, South Africa stands out under black leadership for being well managed. It is the most important democracy in Africa. Mm. It has huge problems. But on the whole, Thabo Mbeki can be blamed for a number of things, certainly his handling of Zimbabwe, certainly his handling of the AIDS crisis, but his handling of the economy and his economic record, if you like, is actually kind of quite sound.
I want to come back and look at that after we take a short break, Martin Meredith, if we could. I want to try and get one more call before that break. Mizrak is calling from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Hi, Mizrak, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm glad your guest he was talking about Ethiopia earlier.
Yes.
The reason I'm originally from Ethiopia, mm-hmm. and I want to give an example because that's a country of 3,000 years old history.
Yes.
And there's no colonial issue, you know, except the Italians were there for 5 years.
Right.
Now, how come the Ethiopian governments, I mean, you did talk about the Derg and Haile Selassie, and then now we have this government for 15 years. Mm-hmm. We're having the same problem in terms of drought. And it's not entire Ethiopia. The south part of Ethiopia is very rich. Ethiopia is
Where do you lay the blame, Mizrak?
Well, I mean, you did ask the best question. What is the path to power in Africa? I think the biggest problem is the rulers. I mean, they are really obsessively selfish, and they're just in their own interests.
Why don't Ethiopians rise up and kick them out and get better ones?
They tried. Currently, yes. We have an election, and they want to kick out the current government who's been there for 15 years, and they don't want to leave. So what can you do? I mean, it's the people are really helpless.
Mizrak, we appreciate your call, and we're glad for it. Martin Meredith, we've just got half a minute before the break, but your response.
Ethiopia is a country which has been difficult to rule, and it's had a tragic history over the last kind of 30 years and so on. But under the present government, although there is a great deal of opposition to it, it has achieved a degree of stability which wasn't there before. I think one can sort of there is a danger of painting Africa in two desperate terms. I think there's a lot of difficulty in Ethiopia, but on the whole there is a stable government there, and it's an awful lot better than the one that preceded it.
We'll come back and speak to that. Martin Meredith is with us. His new book is The Fate of Africa. You can join us. What do you hear in the stories of Martin Meredith? Do you agree with the lessons he's taken from Africa? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, BICON.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the African challenge, and it is an enormous one. Our guest joining us from Oxford, England, and the BBC studios there is Martin Meredith, journalist, historian, and biographer. His big new book is The Fate of Africa, From the Hopes of Freedom to the Heart of Despair, written out of his 40-year experience reporting and researching on Africa. You can join us as well. Do you see reason for hope? Can we afford to despair over Africa? Is that the path to inevitable failure? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Todd is calling from Wellfleet, Massachusetts. Hi, Todd, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Martin. I'm a physician, a child psychiatrist. 35 years ago, my wife and I were in Peace Corps, Liberia, nice. West Africa, doing maternal child health. And more recently, a few years ago, we were in Ghana doing AIDS education, and 2 years ago in Kenya working with AIDS orphans. I don't know that we've fully got the solution to political greed, corruption, and power, but I'll be interested to hear the answer to that. I wanted to ask a different question.
Yes.
What about Jeffrey Sachs' relatively inexpensive solutions to many of the medical and educative problems, mosquito netting, cutting down the mortality of 150,000 children a month, free schools and no uniform or book charges as well as tuition.
Right, rolling up our sleeves and getting in at that very practical level.
Yeah, I mean, what about some of these more hopeful aspects? I'd be interested to hear what Martin has to say about that.
Tata, I'm very glad you raised that. It's right here on my list of questions as well. And Martin Meredith, I want to put it to you. Of course, Jeffrey Sachs, he's been on our show a number of times talking about this and very public lately, the big global economic guru, close with Bono, who's been a big spokesman on this as well. Jeffrey Sachs said not very long ago, Martin Meredith, he said, the G8 is the time for the world to stand up and say no more. He said, climatic disaster, impoverishment, AIDS, malaria, all solvable. There are practical, pragmatic, realizable plans that can do this in my lifetime and yours. That sounds a very different note than you're ringing this morning, Mr. Meredith.
Well, I would agree with him. All those measures, and particularly the field measures, if you like, that can be taken, the mosquito nets, and all the other kind of aids that can be put into Africa are all hugely worthwhile. Indeed, I would say that's the more promising kind of measures than almost any other things.
And yet you've spoken this morning of 30 or 40 more years of fairly desperate circumstances. That's not the horizon Jeffrey Sachs is painting.
No. In a sense, I think what he is doing, and indeed what the G8 leaders are also guilty of doing, is arousing false expectations about what can be achieved. That is, I think, that the emphasis on practical, pragmatic projects like providing mosquito nets and so on, of tackling kind of malaria and tackling AIDS and all those other things. They are hugely worthwhile, but they don't really begin to turn countries round. What they do is assist, if you like, or they prevent the slide into further destitution. At the moment, the extent of aid, of Western aid, in propping up Africa is really kind of pretty extensive. There are now a majority of countries in sub-Saharan Africa which get more than 50% of their budgets provided by Western taxpayers.
That's big.
In other words, already, as it were, the financial assistance given by the West to Africa is huge, and it's not necessarily being put to good effect. I think where Western aid really does have an impact is on the provision of things like mosquito nets, where Western assistance is given for in education and health in particular, but that isn't really beginning to tackle the scale of the problem of where you have public services which hardly kind of function, where you have mass corruption, where you have leaders who are rather like the president of Niger, who are indifferent to the suffering of their own people. So in a sense, what I would agree with, if you like, the pragmatic measures that your caller and that people like Jeffrey Sachs recommend, and all those things are worthwhile, but the scale of the problem is actually much, much bigger than those measures can take account of.
There's a sobering view. Martin Meredith, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Bioli Ireli. He is a professor of African Studies and Romance Languages at Harvard University, born and raised in Nigeria. We've asked him to listen and ride along with us this morning and give us his perspective, on your perspective, if you will, Martin Meredith. Bioli Ireli, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm glad to be able to contribute.
We're delighted to have you. So, here is an earnest journalist and researcher who spent 40 years looking at Africa, and you hear the tone and tack of the opus that he's brought out, The Fate of Africa, a deep critique here of African leadership, and a fairly gloomy view of the next nearly half century from Martin Meredith. What do you hear in this perspective?
Well, I think this the whole problem should be put in a certain perspective, in a certain historical perspective. In the first place, I think many of the problems of Africa are direct results, aftermath of the colonial experience. I mean, I'm not going to blame everything on colonialism, but in fact, there's a kind of reorganization of Africa going on at the moment, and it's necessary, it's had to be very painful.
And even now, 40 years later, how much?
Well, 40 years is a short time.
Yes.
You know, I'll give you an example. I mean, another example that after the revolution in France, 1789,
yes,
it took practically 100 years before the Third Republic was set up, and for a certain stability to come in. Then you had, you know, civil war, coups, and so on, change of regimes, right up to the defeat of the Second Republic in 1870. Before then, attempts were being made to set up a new republic. I'm talking about something like 100 years after the French Revolution.
So you're saying we're judging Africa too harshly, too quickly?
I mean, yes, that's part of it. Yes, definitely. I'm not going to, you know, disculpate the leaders. I think that, you know, the general opinion is correct, that our leaders have failed and so on. But I also want to stress one point, and that is they've had even the case of Tanzania was mentioned with Nyerere.
Yes.
And you can see from that example that, you know, the problems that the leaders themselves have had to deal with have been enormous. We were talking about the whole question of nation building, for instance, you know, I mean, and the tribal structure. Somebody mentioned the tribal structure. Well, that's true. Those are multinational countries, multi-tribal countries, if you like, and there have been quite a lot of internal conflicts. The Congo at the moment illustrates that problem very, very clearly.
And we see the trouble there. Bioli, really, let me ask you, between the view of Martin Meredith, fairly gloomy about the next several decades, and the view of Jeffrey Sachs, which says, come on, let's get in there with a lot of money and roll up our sleeves, do simple, important things, and we can make this better, we can defeat all these issues, where do you find yourself coming down more confidently?
I come down definitely on the side of Jeffrey Sachs.
But is it dreaming? Is it pie in the
dreaming.
Sky?
I mean, you have to start somewhere, and it is very pragmatic, you know, questions of public health, preventive medicine, these are important issues. In fact, let me make a point. We were, in fact, making some progress, you know, in the period after the independence. Right up to, say, about the mid-80s, there was a certain, I might call it a certain ascension, in fact, in many of the African countries. Then the IMF came in, said we shouldn't, in fact, finance social programs.
Right.
We shouldn't finance education. All those social programs were dismantled. Education, there was a whole lot of disruption with this structural adjustment program. And it has meant, in fact, much of the downward spiral that we're witnessing today began then. And before we were able, in fact, to begin really to reconstruct, we were told to stop.
And you're saying, so let's turn it around, let's get in there along
possible,
the Sachs
yes,
formula.
I think it is possible. I think the social programs, you know, need to be restored.
And yet we've heard from you that fear of doom lying behind that belief in optimism.
Well, I don't want to express any kind of naive optimism. There are huge problems, certainly. But we've got to start somewhere. And in any case, to sort of adopt this kind of pessimism, you know, this is disabling. That means that we just throw up our hands and do nothing.
Biola Ireli, you're a great listener, and we appreciate you coming in with your view for us here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Right.
Biola Ireli, professor of African Studies at Harvard University, originally from Nigeria. Martin Meredith, our time grows short. Do you have a prescription in here? Do you have a path? What's the way out of the despair half of your equation?
Yes, I mean, I'm don't want to be kind of overly pessimistic. I really kind of want to be realistic, and I don't think there's much to be gained from, if you like, minimizing the scale of the problem. And I really don't think, as the learned professor was saying, that it has very much to do with the IMF policies or indeed the way in which kind of Africa has the external forces are really to be blamed. Nigeria is a good example. It had an oil bonanza of $280 billion. And pretty well most of it was squandered. Earlier this year, investigators in Nigeria estimated that the Nigerian leadership had looted, and that was the word they used, looted $350 billion in the first 40 years of independence. Now, that is the real nature of the problem. It doesn't have anything kind of to do with colonialism. It actually has to do with government leadership. And Nigeria is an example of a country which has had catastrophic leadership, one after the other, where governments have plundered and looted the country. You now have a government in Nigeria which is trying to kind of turn things around, but they've squandered the enormous bonanza that they had. So I think that if you're looking for, if you like, prescriptions, as you were asking about, there are two necessary parts of a solution. One is, if you like, foreign aid, that nothing really can be turned around without extensive foreign aid.
So put the aid there, and number two?
And number two is good governance. What Africa has suffered from 40 years, and indeed in some cases for 50 years, is the failure of African leaders to provide effective government. Now,
easy to say and clearly hard to realize. Martin Meredith, we're going to have to ask you back to take us further into how that might be done. But we appreciate your long view this morning and the big new book. Martin Meredith, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Martin Meredith, author of The Fate of Africa, From the Hopes of Freedom to the Heart of Despair. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, what's missing from the cover of National Geographic's magazine's latest issue? We'll take a look. This is On Point. The September issue of National Geographic magazine will be devoted exclusively to one topic, Africa. And the magazine has chosen not to use a photograph on the cover for only the second time since 1943. Instead, the cover will feature a white background with the single word Africa. Joining me now is Chris John, a longtime photographer for National Geographic. He has been editor-in-chief of the magazines since January. Chris John, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Tom.
What should we read into this nearly blank cover when it comes to Africa? Where's the photo? Why?
Well, it says Africa, whatever you thought, think again. And we do have one of the core pieces of National Geographic at the bottom, a map of Africa.
What are you suggesting, that we've got a blank slate here in Africa, that the history's all gone, that it's a new day?
Absolutely not. I think you know this, but Africa is not just one place. It's a million different places. And what we do in our issue is show the continent's complexity, which in many ways is seldom recognized and understood. And we felt that no one photo could capture the mystery, diversity, and surprise of Africa and for today and tomorrow. So we felt the thing to do was we want to be provocative. We want people to think about Africa and how important it is really to all of our lives.
We've just heard for the better part of an hour about how deep the difficulties are. You're quoted saying that what you want to do is highlight astonishing stories of renewal, ingenuity, and potential heard through unfiltered African voices, stories that counterbalance the bleak headlines of civil war, disease, poverty, and extinction. So who's got the accurate perspective here? Are you being Panglossian, or is this cheerleading, or do you really see, once again, reason to talk about an African renaissance?
I just returned from Africa 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And what always strikes me in Africa, having worked in Africa for almost 20 years now, is the depth and quality of the voices of Africans. And in our issue, what we talk about are people, individuals like Wangari Maathai, for example, who in 1977 mm-hmm. wanted to stop soil erosion, could see that
Kenya.
There was a direct link between soil erosion and the well-being of Kenyans. And since that time, she and her group have planted 30 million trees to stop soil erosion.
And the Nobel Prize has come her way, yes.
Yeah, I mean, so when you look at those stories and you look at the power of the individual, be it Desmond Tutu, Nelson Mandela, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, there are a lot of ways we can focus on Africa that can really help us deal with problems throughout the world. And I think that's an important thing for us to keep in mind.
Chris Johns, you're a photographer, you're editor-in-chief now. This is National Geographic with a white cover. Does that suggest that there are things, there are complexities that are beyond photography?
Of course there are, yes. I mean, photography in its finest forms can be evocative, it can be emotional, it can be storytelling. But at National Geographic Magazine, we're committed and have a long commitment to some of the finest photography in the world. But we also have a commitment to words, to maps, and that striving for excellence and using those tools to communicate great stories are every bit as important to us as photography.
Of course, Africa has been one of the great sources of National Geographic's images over all these years. Quite a thought to devote a whole issue to that continent that has fed your readers so much through the decades, and no photo on the cover. It's a statement, and we hear it. Chris John, thank you very much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, Tom.
Chris Johns, editor-in-chief of National Geographic magazine. The cover in September, white, to talk about Africa. Whatever you thought, think again, is the headline. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Mike Toda and Angel Cozzelli, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.